So the talk here is about 99AS, and this was a supernova found during the SCP started the first massive nearby search back in the spring of 1999. The program was just to last 3 months long. Our objective was basically spelled out by working on type 1As. So what we wanted at that point, we realized that with the 40 or so high redshift objects that we had and the 25 or so that Brian's group had, that we were both looking at about 18 or 20 supernova at low redshift from Mario Amui. So we wanted to bolster that number up. So we also wanted to find them in an unbiased way. And this is what makes the discovery of this particular supernova interesting. Kate and other people who go out and stare at galaxies, they tend to pick very large galaxies. The reason is they want to fill up their CCD with as much stellar mass as possible to give them the greatest chance of seeing a supernova. Recent work by Mark Sullivan toward the Type 1As show that the Type 1As definitely follow a component, follows the mass, and a component follows the star forming. And so the more mass you have in front of you, the more likely you are to find one. And that's the way they work. We didn't want to do that with this spring 1999 search. What we wanted to do was not point at galaxies, but cover a large fraction of the sky and find them the same way that we found the high redshift ones. Which, you know, you hardly can even tell they're on a galaxy at high redshift. So we also wanted to catch them before peak brightness, and we wanted to have a really good suite of follow-up on the spectroscopy and photometry. So we set up places all over the world. I'll get to the list in a second of where we did this. So we discovered 40 supernova. 20 of them were type 1A, which met the criteria above. It took about 10 FTEs working for 3 months to get this job done. And the computing requirements, I mean, today it isn't that much, but back then it was about 8 spark stations and 32 nodes on a Linux cluster. And about 3 of us would work 18-hour days to get all of the scheduling done and the follow-ups and make sure that the data came in and they looked at the right thing. And so it was a, needless to say, a tremendously large job. Many mistakes were made. Two people suffered horribly from it. One tripped going up to a telescope, and then Greg Aldering suffered paralysis on his entire side of his body from staying up for 4 days straight trying to make things work down at CTIO. So, you know, there were some glitches along the way. But all in all, it was fairly successful given what's done back then. Right now, with the supernova factory, we started with this and we're pushing the supernova factory. The whole idea is to sort of repeat this type of search, actually a factor of two larger, every week instead of every 3 months, and get basically a supernova type 1A every other night, every third night.
Sorry, this is a nearby search?
This was a nearby search. So I can show you, this is, I think our highest redshift type 1A that we followed was redshift 0.13, 0.15 or something like that. But the vast majority of them were between 0.03 and 0.09. And that's where we sort of targeted.
So when you say excellent follow-up, you found one, and then how often did you?
Almost every other night we hit it photometrically, and once a week we hit it spectroscopically, if not more. But the other thing was, we didn't want it based just in one place. I'll show you the list in a second so you can see what we tried doing. So these were the... one thing works, the other doesn't. So these were the search groups that we worked with. Eros was a French group. Mark Phillips and Chris Smith and Nick Sunseff did a mosaic search. With follow-up at CTIO, but this was on the KPNO telescope. Neat, this is the one where we found 99AS. Actually, this is an amazing set of data. Well, there are also two other ones here, Spacewatch and Quest. But if you look at Neat, it sort of sticks out. Only 15 hours worth of data. Okay, that includes the references. Okay, 425 square degrees of the sky were covered down to about magnitude 18.7 or so. Pixels were chunky, about arc second pixels. And we found five supernova independently. We actually found six. We found 99 AC was, or AA was also in our data. Unfortunately, when you have 10 FTEs working on it and you don't exactly have the money to pay 10 FTEs, you go down and you get an undergraduate, and when the undergraduate's looking at a big NGC galaxy and there's a blob right there, he somehow missed it and went by, so we didn't discover 99 AA until later. But of that, this was just one night's worth of data. It did 425 square degrees in one night, and we found those supernova. So what's great about NEAT? Well, they just paved the sky. And when they did it, we were able to then hit it with follow-up at these observatories. And as you can see,
Can you tell us what the telescope was for NEAT?
NEAT, this is the Haleakala telescope. This is the one on Maui. It is a, what is it? Just under a 2 meter. And you can see at that time, it's different now. This is the Near Earth Asteroid Telescope. They had one. It was joint owned by Air Force and by JPL. JPL now runs the NEAT search. They still do it there, but the data is next to worthless compared to the data they can get out of Palomar. And that's where now, if you hear the term NEAT, you're thinking JPL and Palomar, and it's the Schmidt that's paved.
48-inch
with equipment. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This was the one on Haleakala, slightly, definitely less throughput. A lot of other problems, like the Air Force sergeant smoking at the middle of the night and turning on his flashlight to find his cigarettes. That was a bunch of interesting exposures we got. So we observed it lick down in Chile with YALO and the CTIO 0.9 and 1.5 meters. We observed the Danish 1.5 meter. And then, of course, all these search facilities that we labeled here, many of them were going back and just paving the sky again in VNR, and so we would use that data as well. The spectroscopy, the 3-meter, KPNO 4-meter and 2.1 meter, CTIO 4-meter and 1.5 meter and the ESO 3.6 meter. So we tried spreading things around so we wouldn't get hit by weather, and all in all, it worked out pretty well. So this was the discovery. It was actually discovered by Gerson Goldhaber, but unfortunately he ignored it right after he discovered it, because this is what he saw. Here are our reference images. This is an inverted reference image. And then he just saw this in our new images. Okay, it's there. It's not a cosmic ray. It's not an asteroid. These images were taken more than an hour apart from each other, so it wasn't moving. It was magnitude 17.5, which is pretty bright, but you have to look really hard. This is the host galaxy right here. There's not much of a host there at all. So it was ignored. It was given a very low priority. It was discovered on February 18th. And because it didn't have a host, we were like, oh, it could be a variable star. There are a lot of those at this magnitude that pop up. So about a week or so later, Greg was down on the MDM telescope taking some spectra. And I said, hey, Greg, we got this object. Why don't you just take a spectrum of it real quick to see what it is? And March 6th, he got around to finally taking the spectrum, and this is what he saw. It wasn't a good night at MDM. I don't know what a good night at MDM is, but that's another thing. You could see here, okay, well, there's strong atmospheric absorption here, but you could definitely see supernova-like features, but it wasn't a 1A. And because the host was so faint, we didn't get a redshift, so we couldn't piece it together. So that's what we started with. We said, okay, it sort of looks like a supernova, but it's not a 1A. It's not one of the ones in our major program. Greg flew from Arizona that week and then went down to Chile and took this spectrum because he had a spot, a hole in the night, on March 16th, almost 10 days later. And now, all of a sudden, we see a really nice supernova. It's clearly a 1BC. Looking across here, you can see calcium, IR triplet over here, oxygen, here's silicon. This edge is getting cut off by the night skyline here, the B-band. You have iron, titanium, calcium, and then going down to Iron Peak. But the one thing that is very strange here are these narrow features all throughout the spectrum. Okay? We're able to get a nice redshift now. Greg also sat on the host long enough, and the redshift was 0.127. So if you took our discovery magnitude of 17.5 and you assume a Hubble constant of 70, you get an absolute magnitude of minus 21.2. This was, until about 5 days later, the brightest supernova ever discovered. The supernova 1999 BA, which is a 2N, we just have one data point on it, is actually at minus 21.5. So that was brighter, but we have no idea if that was at peak or what. So all of a sudden, this became an interesting object. One of the things we're always worried about at high redshift with the type 1As is contamination from type 1BCs, since they are very similar. If you look here, here are some type 1BCs that we look at, you know, that we see occasionally. 98BW are our famous high velocity 1BCs. More typical, 94I. And here is 99AS, and you can see it's rather similar to 94I at peak brightness, with the exception of these narrow lines right here. So Greg and I decided that it would be a good thing to follow this thing up, for the very least to improve our ability to discriminate against type 1C objects, 1BC objects, at high redshift from the 1As. So this was the suite of spectroscopy. So here's the first spectrum from MDM. And then here are the spectra going out to day 55. These are in rest frame. So what you can see is, as a function of time, these narrow lines, which are basically iron and titanium, persist for 40 days in the rest frame. The other thing is they don't change velocity. These lines, I'll show a fit in a second, where they come from, but they stay fixed very much at a similar velocity the whole way through. And you can see the spectrum hardly evolves at all over this time frame. Perhaps there's a little evolution between here and here, but it's hard to say. It's a rather noisy spectrum. But going over those 30 days, not much is going on whatsoever. So if you look at those narrow lines, and we reported these in the IAU circular because they clearly stuck out, how do you form them? And so one way you can think about forming them is that you have some shell on top of your photosphere. Well, if you do that, if you look at how the P Cygni profile forms, you get a wide absorption trough because you're blocking all this area here, and you get a huge emission feature. And if you go back, we don't see those type of things here at all. We just see something that cuts in and out. So the only way you can make a feature like that narrow without emission is to have a detached shell of material. And if you go through and do the line identification on all of these lines, and this is a model by Dan Kaysen, in which he has basically a type 1BC with a photospheric velocity of about 8,000 kilometers a second or so. And then he has a shell of material 2,000 kilometers a second wide sitting at 11,000 kilometers a second. And that shell of material is completely comprised of iron 2 and titanium 2. Now, you can have other things out there, but not much, because we don't see things like calcium in this shell. And calcium is very strong. So it's definitely an iron peak dominated shell. Okay, calcium you'd expect to see out there because it's as strong as any of these other lines. So this is a rather interesting predicament. But you can see these lines throughout. There are about 20 or 30 of them that you can go through and identify as either iron 2 or titanium 2. throughout the entire spectrum. And you can see them as a function of time, and they're not changing.
Where is the shell supposed to be? Like, where are you imagining?
So there are many things, and so I want to start some discussion at the end of this talk, because I'm sort of clueless about how such things could happen. I mean, you could imagine a... So why do we think it's a shell? Well, I don't think it's a set of blobs. I think that would be difficult. Perhaps it could be blobs of ejecta that came out, synthesized ejecta that came out. I don't think that, because of another reason, which has to do with the brightness of this object at the end. And I think there's some circumstellar interaction going on in order to get the brightness that we see. So that's why I think there's this shell. Now, why the shell has the composition it has, how the shell got there in the first place, I'm not positive.
But how far out would you imagine it?
Well, so this is 11... Well, let me show you the light curves next, which are even more interesting, and then you can get an idea for how large this is. So these are the BVRI light curves, nominally put to the date of discovery here in R-band. What you can notice in both V and R is you get a little bit of a plateau right here, about 40 days after discovery. These have all been brought back into the rest frame. But V-band decays linearly in magnitude here. I-band does similarly. We can take this, we can take all the spectra, put it together, and make a bolometric-like curve. And this is what it does. And it's probably good to about 20% is what I would imagine. But the interesting features for this are the width of this. If you look at how this drops, it's falling off like a type 1A does after the first 15 days. You can sort of see it drop down here by, magnitude and a half. Well, it's about 1.5 times broader than a 1A. But the strange thing is that it keeps on dropping down to day 80.
How does it compare to 94i?
The light curve? Volumetric? 94i hasn't even made the bottom of this graph here. Okay, and 94i rose in what, 7, 8 days? I mean, it was rather quick. And then it had dropped by this much, down here.
So 91t?
91t peaks right about here.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Okay. A regular type 2P is down here. Two N's, most two N's that we see are sort of around magnitude minus 20. So this is extreme. And if you look at the spectra, so this is the first thing. I think interaction is playing some role. I'll get to that in a bit. But if you look at the spectrum, there's nothing like a continuum washing out the stuff in there. There doesn't appear to be at all. Matter of fact, how could you even envision seeing these narrow lines if that was the case? The spectra don't evolve that much as a function of time. So, in any case, very odd. But this is the disturbing part, actually, in Ken and his group, Jin Song, and Ben fitting this, and this actually turns out to be the troublesome part. And another interesting thing, okay, now this is, well, hey, I'm at a GRB conference, so I'm going to pull this out, okay, but I don't necessarily believe it. So about a year later after we got this thing, I started going through on a side project and searching for, I don't know who wrote the paper, the guy at Chicago wrote that paper about how all the associations with Don wrote that paper. And so the first thing he asked me to do was, could I search through all the SCP's high redshift data, okay, for all the 1As and see if there was anything coincident a month before with a GRB, because he just wanted to show and sort of... Actually, it turned out there were none that were coincident. But I ran it on our whole data set of supernova, both nearby and high, and this one was the only one that came out with one that was coincident. And 40 days before we discovered it, okay, well, perhaps you can envision a light curve that goes like this. I don't know. What? This is all in rest frame here.
Rest frame.
Yeah, it's 40. It is 46.4 days in observer frame. So I think that winds up being 40.1 or something like that. Okay. This was a non-triggered VATSI burst, a Stern burst. So it's, you know, weak. You can see the uncertainty in the part of the sky is, you know, that large. Okay. But I would be a fool not to go through and say I at least looked for something. Well, okay, there's something there. Do I give it any weight whatsoever? No, I don't think so.
I mean, there's one burst today in VATSI. So isn't this completely consistent with just
random luck? Well, yeah, other than...
You've got a solid angle.
That's 30 in degrees, yeah.
Right.
Radius or diameter?
That is...
It's a radius. It's 10% of the
sky. No. That's a one sigma diameter, and that's sort of being it. The diameter. I looked at the thing. Is sort of like this big ellipse, and it's the long part. Is what they gave. So.
So if it's one, it's, you know, 1/40th of the sky. Then,
right.
Then there you are.
Yeah. Not much. Yeah. Okay. So that's why I said. But I just, you know. Somebody would kick me if I didn't go looking for it. So I looked, and there it is. And now I get kicked for looking for it. So, you know, what, you know. It's a lose-lose proposition. In any case, I don't like this because I'll show you, well, some models that I think I sort of trust. So here are some simple models. Now, okay. First thing, no interaction. So how can you do something like this? Well, you got two constraints. One, the spectra are not evolving that much. Because of that, you have to have a lot of mass out there. If you have a lot of mass out there, and nickel's powering everything that you're seeing, okay, then you need a lot of nickel. Okay, and of course, the more mass you have, the more nickel you have, and it becomes this game very quickly where, you know, you start getting into silly land here with total nickel masses. But if you look, here's a fit for, I assumed, about 16, 17 solar masses of material on top of either 2 or 5 solar masses of nickel. And you get a light curve like this, and it's not so consistent with the GRB anyway, so I don't believe it. They rise much, much more quickly. The problem is that nothing in the models gets this type of fall off here at late times. This type of fall off, though, is seen in a lot of other objects like 98S. You have that type of linear fall off at late time. Yes, sir.
Now, the rise time for that looks like 15 days.
Yep.
And given its brightness, my guess is regardless of the mass, you'd have to have a huge radius to get it that bright.
That quickly.
Because the temperature doesn't have a particularly high temperature.
No.
So why is it so bright without a fairly large radius, radius at the time of emission, which implies a high velocity?
Yeah, so I used an effective velocity of 30,000 kilometers a second to get something like this.
That's inconsistent with your spectrum.
Well, so there's a hydrokinetic energy. So that translates to what was really the kinetic energy. It's not that doesn't necessarily translate to what is the photospheric velocity. Okay, there's not a...
Okay, but if the photosphere...
Right. If you're trying to do it based on the photosphere, then you would expect a much longer rise time.
Yeah.
And in fact, it jives very nicely with the 40 days. I mean, you just look at it. It's got a fall similar to how it rises, you know. And
right. So, I mean, I guess that's the problem when I see the models that rise like this. I think the big mystery to me looking at that
yeah.
The velocity is low.
Right.
The brightness is high.
Right.
And you can have flux dilution, so, but you're not going to have that much.
Right. If you look...
Small ejected mass, then. If you look at the distributed small ejected mass...
Well, you can. The problem is the spectrum doesn't have high velocity. So
the spectrum has, so these spectra compared to all other type 1 VCs, this is almost at the absolute lowest. If we assume this was near peak brightness, this is at the absolute lowest end of kinetic energy we've ever seen in a 1 VC.
Right. And so if you have huge mass, you can get it, but it's going to take a long time.
Takes you a long time to get there.
A long time to get your R squared.
But it depends on the distribution of people. If you have enough
equal
in high velocity, then you get.
Right.
You're still struggling with 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth with some dilution factor.
Anyway,
still have to have r, which is going to be your photospheric velocity, big. I don't see any way around that.
The 50 days is a bit difficult. I agree with you.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the effective temperature of this thing here, it's about 7,500 Kelvin, 7,000, something like that. Okay? So if you compare that to like a type 2 supernova, its radius has got to be 100 times larger at the same phase. You know?
It means it has to have expanded. I mean,
it's got to start expanding.
There's flux dilution, but there's not going to
right.
be. It's going to be a factor of 5.
Right. So if you go down that path, which is another thing you can do with these sort of toy models, the total mass you wind up having, so you got very little kinetic energy, you got a long time to rise, you got to have a lot more mass and a lot of nickel. You know, there's no other way around it.
Could you use kind of Arnett
type? Yeah, this is sort of a back of the envelope Arnett type of model, just to show crudely how much nickel you need to get up in that range. I'm more interested here in the peak, but a generic characteristic of any model, even if you had it matching what you're saying with the kinetic energy, is they're not going to fall like this. And that.
So you need if you had a slower one, you need even more nickel than what you're using.
I believe that's the way it goes. Yeah.
Well, sure, because it moves the peak sooner, and this is just an Arnett model, so the peak
right.
is the nickel mass. But if it's 50 days old, it's lower.
Yeah, yeah.
It just drives you into an area of parameter space which you just don't want to go to. You know, not you know, so.
How do you drive the volumetric luminosity?
So what I did was I took all of the spectra that we had. I basically fit them then with a black body to extend them out to the infrared and to the ultraviolet. I actually looked at some modeling here that showed me what the ultraviolet was doing. And then I took the photometric data, scaled all the spectra to these observations here, and then did a volumetric correction based on those.
I guess especially at nighttime and just the infrared.
If you look at the spectral evolution here, it's getting a little cooler. But I'm not envisioning, I mean, this spectrum right here, the photometry, the very last photometry points we have are only 10 days after this spectrum was taken. So, you know, assuming here it's sort of going from, this is like an 8 or 9,000 degree black body, 7,000 to about 6,000. I think probably.
But even new down there, unless the IR just does this, and there's just all this flux that comes up.
Yeah. It could be a possibility. That's why, I mean, if you look, the uncertainties I ascribe to doing that extrapolation are about 20%, and I think that's totally reasonable. I can't envision supernova doing things that are that bizarre out in the infrared or UV. More than 20%. So, and here's the date of our last spectrum was taken with these photometry points right here. So, I don't think it's a huge extrapolation there either.
Was there an nebular spectrum taken?
No. Well, I mean, so look at, I mean, it. This was back in the day when getting 2 hours on Keck to do something like this was difficult. Although you did call me from Subaru once, but they had infrared instruments on, so. So let's see. Where am I? So We went back to Keck this past year. So one of the problems with the Spring 99 data is that it was taken on about 15 different telescopes. So it took a tremendously long time for us to reduce the photometry. But it's finally been done. And then we started going up and cleaning up things. So one of the things we did was went and took a better look at this galaxy, and we got a spectrum of an H2 region inside the galaxy and of the galaxy itself. And I went through and did my old graduate school measurements based on the oxygen, hydrogen-oxygen ratio, and basically came up with a metallicity that's a third solar or less than that. That's sort of an upper limit. The host itself is around LMC type brightness. So I guess those, both the H2 region and the brightness of the host, are consistent with this being a lower metallicity than average galaxy. Let's see. So are there other supernova like this? This is a really interesting thing. So I started going through all of the 1BCs that I could get a hold of, and I didn't see anything that looked like 99 AS at all. And then in 2001, Lifan was observing for me down at Kitt Peak, and a supernova went off, 01BB, which Weidong Li discovered. And I said, Lifan, go ahead, take a spectrum of it. The great thing about this supernova was Weidong had an image at the galaxy that went very deep just 5 days before, and there was absolutely nothing there. So whatever this was a very young event. And if you look at the spectrum of 99 AS, you can see the narrow iron lines here. Boom, 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 the three big ones right here around 5,000. You can see the same thing in 01BB, just at higher velocity. Okay? The next day, this spectrum looked like 94i. You could not see those narrow lines anymore. They were gone. Okay? You can also see hints of the titanium ones, although they're weaker. This spectrum is at a, well, much earlier epoch, I think, than we caught 99 AS. Now, the luminosity of this guy, down here, magnitude minus 16.5. There was some extinction, so maybe magnitude minus 17. Okay. Well, we got all excited about this, but this thing faded so quickly, it dropped a magnitude in just 5 days. So we couldn't basically follow it anymore. It just got so faint for us. We were like, forget about it. But I do think that if we start looking at some 1BCs very early, this type of signature may be there in more than one. You can see hints of it in the spectra of 94i. You can see iron lines. If you look, they're coincident. They don't scream out at you like either of these spectra, where you can definitely see them. So I'm going to wind up here by talking about one thing I did, which was going through all of the SCP high redshift data, all of the SNLS spectroscopy, and right now, to date, we have 159 supernova that we've ID'd with SN Factory. Not a single one of them looks like or behaves like 99 AS. And 99 AS would look like a type 1A at high redshift. I mean, the colors and everything, it's a UV suppressed black body, and so somebody would trigger on it. The effective volume of these things is such that back in the early days when we first started searching for high redshift supernova, and say we were targeting a redshift of 0.6, you could easily find one of these at a redshift of 1. And likewise, as we pushed to a redshift of 1, you could have found one of these much farther out. Because of that, and because the light curve is so broad and they stay up there for so long, it's just the probability of finding one of these is so great. And yet, they're, out of these almost 600 supernova, not a single other event looks like this. So it's got to be incredibly rare. Looking at piecing it all together, if you look at the density profile, Dan Kaysen has run some models, some light curve models, where he tries to simulate everything. You basically get a density profile that then has a peak, and you were pointing these out to me yesterday. You get this peak starting about 9,000 kilometers a second, going out to 11,000 kilometers a second. You get this, you know, just bump in the density out there. And that has to be a very significant bump because it persists. You know, you get these things expanding out there at 11,000 kilometers a second. There's got to be a lot of mass. There's got to be a lot of density out there. What made that bump? And to me, a natural explanation is, and also to get that brightness, is the supernova slammed into something and plowed up part of its atmosphere, and that caused the density spike. But I don't know how to do any of those calculations. I don't know how to run through any of that type of modeling to say, okay, can you get that? And then the hot continuum, then that adds to the supernova. You know, can you then take something that's maybe a slightly more luminous type 1bc, add on some amount of interaction, get a spectrum that looks like that, that evolves like that, and get those type of brightnesses, you know, without seeing other things like there's, and what did it run into? Is it running into carbon and oxygen with some iron? Is it running into something that's much more iron peak element dominated? You know, how do you get that? But all those things to me say should look at interaction. Also, that's a nice way of explaining the late portion of the light curve where it's dropping so quickly. Things like 98S show very, very similar type behavior. But other than that, I'm very confused about how to sort of proceed with this supernova other than I should just put it together and publish it and just say I'm confused and an idiot. But, you know, leave it to you guys who deal with these interaction type stuff to worry about it. So that's it.
I don't think it's completely unlikely that you will get it from your cell interaction. If it's running into something, whatever it is, you will not probably not see very much of that. Because that's heated up to 10 to 9 degrees. So.
Right, but what about...
I mean, what you will see is reverse shock, and if that's cooling, then you might get a very thin, dense trail. What's surprising is that you see so no ionization stages as iron 2 and titanium 2.
Yeah, it's the titanium 2 that's even more surprising than anything else, because that suggests temperatures that are only 5 or 6,000 degrees Kelvin, that's it.
That is actually something you could get if this reverse shock is cooling, because then it will really cool down to very low temperature. It will be extremely dense and it will be very cold. Like with ordinary typical solar effect, this way this reverse shock cools down so that you get magnesium 2 and very high densities. That will also explain the magnetic effects.
But the reverse shock wouldn't go. As far as I know,
you're just saying it's solar composition or whatever.
Carbon oxygen probably.
Carbon oxygen.
Yeah.
With a bit of iron.
Yeah.
What you will see in terms of absorption, I said that will only be iron, I think, because they're the only ones having resonance lines.
Well, calcium does too, and we don't see it.
Calcium has it, and that is a bit surprising. You don't see that, but in principle, you could. That should get that as an issue, because you will scatter out the HEK lines. They will come up with the calcium triplets.
Yeah, and we don't see the triplet because it's too far to the red at that redshift for our spectra.
So we don't have a trace from the calcium.
I don't think so. I'm trying to look at our. We stop right here. That oxygen, because the redshift was just high enough, we lose the infrared triplet.
But how are you gonna? Well, I mean, the problem is the calcium too. There's a narrow component there; you're not going to see it anyway, right? Because you got it's all chewed up by
that calcium.
By the broad one.
It might be. That's one of the things that you'd have to put in the model is, can you do just a carbon oxygen solar abundance type of thing, and can you hide the calcium?
But that's of course a very good way of getting higher luminosities, if I sort of say that.
Right. Yes, and so.
You don't think they need any
But can you get that type of interaction and not wash out this spectrum through the continuum? I mean, so say we have a normal 1DC down here that's 3 magnitudes fainter than the continuum component of the interaction. I mean, those features would be
good. So much of this is string continuum.
I mean, look at these. The feature depths are very similar to 94i.
That's the problem.
This is where you run into these, you know, so part of you saying, oh, I got to go to, like what Brian pointed out, very massive thing that took a very long time to rise, has a lot of nickel under it. I don't like that because how do I make 5 solar masses of nickel? And then the other part says, oh, continuum interaction, but then I can't get a spectrum that looks like a 1BC plus continuum.
Because the interaction spectrum, in this case, has to give you these broad normal features, which are normally photospheric features, right? Because I always think of the continuum spectrum. You can imagine your narrow absorption things, but then you expect this to have a hot, right, continuum underneath it.
You'll get lines also for the, I mean, if you have the interaction, you'll get broad lines from the X-rays going into the reactor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that could be these broad features.
You think the X-rays could be responsible for some of these?
Yeah, I mean, it just needs something heating. I mean, it doesn't really care whether it's X-rays or gamma rays,
yeah,
or whatever it is.
I still think R has to be very big, even if you do that, because it still just means that you're eliminating the photosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the rays have to be larger.
Yeah.
That's true. But you automatically get there.
Well, only with lots of time.
According to that branch model, you will get different line profiles if you assume it's heating from
the top
yeah,
down heating is, it gives you very different, I think it does give you very different line profiles than these.
But I mean, the problem here is that you have an enormous blend of iron and with both iron 2 and iron 3 probably.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can definitely...
So the spectrum you get, I mean, you don't see clear line profiles at all. I mean, these are just blends.
Well, this is O1,
yeah,
and that's calcium H and K. Well,
yeah, that's about it.
If you're running into something so dense, do you see narrow lines from the shock which is going into that?
Is there a way to get the reverse shock to stop after 2,000 kilometers a second? I mean, is that, it's the cooling?
I mean, that's a bit more.
Yeah.
If you're running into something like the 87A ring, for example,
yeah,
that's a much
closer,
and then you'll get, well, the forward shock will be a low velocity shock,
mm-hmm,
the reverse shock will be high velocity, when it's just
yeah,
a reverse situation. And, that way you can get something. But when you ring, at these early times, you really have to have a very high density.
Yeah, that's the thing. You got to have a dramatic increase. And I mean, the additional is the evolution. I mean, look at how long this has been expanding here, and yet you still maintain these lines. That's the other thing.
Looks like the wrong way. The reverse shock is, you have to be stuck.
Yeah.
At a velocity.
At a velocity.
So it's actually not moving. Well, yeah, it's just sort of stuck in.
But if it's hitting a wall and the reverse shock is going up a very steep gradient, it could be
It's literally just stuck right at the same mass border.
I mean, that is exactly what the 870 is doing.
So questions for the, so we know this object is rare, okay? Why don't we see this with more 1BCs? Slamming into something.
In principle, it could be a very recent mass injection.
How far out would it get?
The probability of seeing that is
11,000 kilometers a second. Is that?
No, but how many days? So I'm just trying to figure out how far out would you have some high density stuff? Like if it's going.
Well, this is 55 days after discovery.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what the problem is. Well, how about a more radical
suggestion? Oh, please.
Well, it's very rare. Let's say it's related to a jet-induced supernova of some description and happened to be pointed towards us. And so you actually have a non-relativistic thing which punched out, which is iron-rich. And is the whole thing really did produce lots of nickel. And this thing's pointed and you have a blob of stuff that's been drug out of the bottom. And you do have a very high blob of material, which is the jet that just sort of didn't quite make it. It's relativistic jet, and you have a big blob of nickel and iron coming out at 11,000 kilometers a second. It's just a hunk of material there, which is slower than everything else behind it.
So if you take, say, so you want to get 3 magnitudes worth of beaming?
No.
How many?
Not much at all. There's no beaming because it's not relativistic. We know it's only moving 11.
Yeah, no. What are you talking? Something aspherical, or are you just?
Yeah, I'm just saying that this is a super duper nova.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? It produced super duper.
Mm-hmm.
Super duper nova that did produce large quantities of nickel. It's rare. It did produce nickel. It's moving slow, but it happens to have a jet that probably over a large fraction of the surface that's not moving very fast, but it has drugged iron up from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I'd call that a more radical suggestion.
I mean, the problem is to get the reasonable coverage. It can be a jet.
No, it's a failed jet, so it's one that is gone. Mushroomed out.
So it's a super duper dud.
So the issue is that but it's moving slow and lots of nickel is hard.
Well, I think 11,000 and lots of nickel.
It just makes it.
That's exactly what Kate is going to be in the bipolar probe. And on top, there's the nickel. It's very exactly at this velocity.
Yeah, I'm happy with that, but are you going to make 2 to 5 solar masses of nickel?
Impossible.
You
can't
do that, so you have to have something
there.
You have to go to 100
for
a mass.
Yeah, so you either
you need a lot of mass to make this happen. Yeah. So it's a one in a, well, there aren't very many of these.
Yeah.
Imagine you have a big star that produced all this stuff, and it's sort of maybe even risen just by buoyancy or something. I don't know. I mean, it's...
Well, it's an upper limit. I don't know what the...
Yeah. There are not galaxies out there that are less than 20th or 30th solar.
Right.
They're that big.
I mean, this kind of narrow feature that's seen in the cancer lines for 1S and so on, that very early time.
Yeah.
For number of 1S.
Well,
and
it's a massive person that.
Yeah.
Made from the light rose. The high velocity of calcium.
Yeah.
But that's a similar blobby crud in front, but it's not iron.
Right.
That's the interesting thing is that.
There is no so in 1As, if you just take a sort of normal solar composition out there, or carbon-oxygen solar composition, and then, get a little density spike, first thing you see at these temperatures, calcium. You don't see iron. They're much weaker. You know?
It could be, with Klaus's saying, very dense and cool, and then the iron will be better.
Yeah, if it cools down a lot, maybe if it's around 2,000 degrees or something like that, then yeah. So.
So my basically is some combination of the energetic explosion and the psychological. Maybe we might need both.
From the light curves that you were showing me yesterday to explain this type of fall off at the end, if you just had, say, a 20% circumstellar contribution, that's all you would need to, and have that go away, that would then allow you to have that type of drop right there.
What happens if the nickel is out high so that your optical depth, the gamma rays, is just... You're beginning. If the nickel is out,
yeah. If you mix the nickel out, yeah.
I'm already saying that I think the nickel's mixed out, and just, if you have two or three solar masses of it, it's going to absorb itself at some point.
It's still very difficult.
Pardon?
It's still very difficult to get the fast drop at the nucleus.
Even just because it self absorbs itself.
Yeah, something. Anyway, people that test it, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Sort of. Look at the late phase here, it's still absolute magnitude minus 19. So it's still trapping a lot of gammas.
Well, but you're saying your models are going too slow, right?
My models are going too slow.
Yeah,
no, what I'm saying is it's a losing battle between mixing, you know, it's just like the other one, more mass, more nickel. Well, I put it out there, okay, that solves one problem, but it does it at the cost of another.
And you mixed it out.
If you hit something so dense, though, wouldn't your forward shock slow down so much that you won't get this kind of a luminosity later on, after that? You destroy it down considerably, right, if you hit something so dense.
At the peak, let's say you kind of ignore how much nickel you need for the peak, how much nickel do you need to put in the tail? If you were allowing yourself to mess up the peak,
I don't know.
Lower solar masses of nickel would fit that, so then you could
sort of just hit this part right here? I don't know. Yeah, it's like a 1A, probably a half solar.
About 1 or 2, I think.
1, yeah.
So you're kind of saying I need something like 2 to 5 solar masses to fit the peak, and maybe there'd only be a half powering the light curve at late times.
Well, one, a half of that. Yeah. 2 solar masses down to 1.
Well, hold on. It's already at minus. At minus 19.5 is 60. And
yes, exactly.
The half life of nickel is gone, so you're looking at cobalt.
Right.
Cobalt.
That's one E folding. That's one E
folding. Well.
Okay, that's one E folding time for cobalt. Yeah.
You know, cobalt just doesn't have as much bang for the buck as nickel does. So it's not so much that the cobalt's E fold, it's just that it's slower to release its energy.
Yeah, yeah, no, less energy.
So
and
it's got to be a lot out there as well, especially if you can figure it's not trapping all the gamma.
Well, that's what I mean. How much needs to be really internal that is being trapped still to drive that? So could you take what you said and have some portion of the nickel get out far enough that its gamma rays really aren't doing anything driving at late times?
Yeah, no, that would be my scenario, that it has to be, but you have to play around with the model. I can't do the gamma ray transport in my head.
So, but this is the slope. What's the slope compared to? I mean, you have a slope there. So is it right for all traffic of the cobalt?
This slope right here? No, right?
Yeah, so the cobalt, it would be that sort of cobalt.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Okay, great.
This is cobalt.
Yeah.
So cobalt sort of, you know, explains that.
Well, you're going to get nickel to begin, and then...
Each rising time is similar, 60 days or something.
Yeah, in that type of model.
Yeah, I think
that rising time plays a lot with the bigger distribution, the modified solution. Play a lot with the bigger distribution. Yeah, I still don't get
that. Yeah. Well, if Chip Ark were here, he would say this is the best evidence that redshifts aren't cosmological.
That's the really bad one.
The other thing, why haven't we seen one of these at high redshift yet?
Well, let me be a cynic. and say that about two-thirds of our spectra, we type the 1A based on calcium, which would look exactly like you see, and you don't see the sulfur.
It's so much more narrow. It's so much more narrow, you know. This 1A would be two times as wide as that.
But we have one object which I will say we type as 1A from the spectrum, which is way too bright by the magnitude.
That 1A I was showing you yesterday. Has very narrow features, almost like this one. Nothing beyond 9,500 kilometers a second. 8/10 of a magnitude brighter than a normal 1A.
Yeah. But we have one like that as well.
Yeah. Oh, it's 109 solar mass star. JWST should be seeing lots of this.
Hopefully, I will still be
doing astronomy
when I have.
So I just wanted to announce, Tim Brown is giving a talk today at 4 on extrasolar planets over in Broida, for those of you who are interested. It's on the schedule that you might not know this soon. So for those of you
what aspect of
it? We'll take two talks. I'll send the abstract around. That's a good idea. I'll send it around GRB06.
I think it was something with transients.
It was the transits, yeah. Transits.
Okay, this time, Peter.